Hi there. It's time now for your friendly neighborhood economist, the show where you'll hear what's going on with the economy locally, nationally, and internationally, explained to you in plain English. Promise. Welcome to your friendly neighborhood economist show number 028, Midterm Election Palooza. Today, I'll be reviewing the economic plans of the platforms of candidates for governor, comptroller, and U.S. representative, and discussing the impacts of minimum wage and living wage increases with Jeanette Wickslim of the Political Economy Research Institute of Amherst, Mass. But first, as always, the news. Starting off with local business news. A new resort hotel for the Catamount ski area in Kopek is in the works, with permit applications filed and pending. Construction of the upscale hotel and spa is scheduled to begin in the spring, and the first block of rooms will be open for July of 2016. But of course, the big story of the past month, well, it was an interesting month, shall we say, for the planned Ginsberg's facility in Ghent, to say the least. On September 10th, the Ghent Zoning Board of Appeals approved the variances required for the project to move forward. The company is hoping to break ground this month. Beginning a week later, though, Sam Pratt published a series of stories on his blog, and the Register Star also covered the story quite a bit. The first highlighted possible conflicts of interest in the process of approving county support for the project. Ken Flood, Executive Director of Columbia Economic Development Corporation, or CEDC, also Commissioner of Columbia County Planning and Economic Development, and Executive Director of the Columbia County Industrial Development Agency, IDA, was hired in a process led by then-President of the CEDC, David Ginsberg, who, after resigning from the presidency of the CEDC, remained on its board until the fall of last year, when it became clear that Ginsberg's would not be able to receive a loan from the CEDC while he was still on the board. Shortly after he stepped down, the state approved $1.5 million in tax credits and financing for the project. Ginsberg was succeeded as president by David Crawford, whose firm has acted as Ginsberg's agent in getting permits for the project from Claverick and Ghent, while the CEDC was pushing the project. At the public hearing regarding Ginsberg's payment in lieu of taxes, or pilot, Patty Matheny of the group Ghent Can presented documents disclosing that the land sold to Ginsberg for just $1 in the deal was actually purchased by the county for just under $110,000 and not inherited as had previously been reported. Although Ginsberg's Vice President John Bruzzi was on hand at the meeting and photographing residents who spoke at the meeting, only one member of the IDA board attended. A Taconic Hills School Board meeting was the venue for a further revelation that the pilot program for Ginsberg's would mean it would save $664,875 on its projected $1.06 million tax bill for the first 12 years of the project. The company also has received a $400,000 loan from the CEDC, by far the largest the CEDC has outstanding to local businesses, and the only one at the low, low rate of 1%. Ginsberg's was reported to have had $142 million in revenues in 2013, so not clear why they need a $400,000 loan at low interest rate from Columbia County. But anyway, the last week, the Columbia County Board of Supervisors decided to ask for their money back on the land that the CEDC gifted to Ginsberg's, with Board Chair Patrick Rattan writing a letter to the CEDC demanding the county be made whole. The CEDC, the next morning, in an emergency meeting, asked for time to discuss the matter. Meanwhile, the Board of Supervisors is putting together a subcommittee to reevaluate the relationship that it has with the CEDC. So that was exciting. I think the best way to sum this up is with just one word.
Now
On to municipal finance news. A judge has dismissed the petition opposing the replacement of two communication towers on Blue Hill on Eager Farm and Livingston with another tower of the same height but six times as wide. Local emergency services need the upgrade for their outdated emergency communications, but Scenic Hudson and the Olana Partnership oppose the site 2 miles south of the Olana House, claiming it degrades Olana's viewshed. The Green Board Town Board voted to oppose the current plan for locating the new Mental Health Association of Columbia Green County's Greenport Gardens facility on Joslyn Boulevard, although the Planning Board itself has the final approval. The State Comptroller's audit of the Germantown Fire District found that the district needs to institute more transparent budgeting and improve oversight over spending and policy implementation. Meanwhile, the City of Hudson's utility bill increased by one-third in 1 year, according to a report from the Common Council, which called into question the fiscal prudence of switching the city to Viridian wind power. In energy news, Assemblyman Pete Lopez has joined the chorus of voices concerned about the Energy Highway's power line upgrades impacts on the Hudson Valley. He's calling for proof that there's an actual need for such a project. Coincidentally, there will be two events to publicize the results of a study done by Bard College Research Professor of Environmental Science and Physics, Guido Neschel, for the Hudson Valley Smart Energy Coalition and Bard College on October 18 in Claverick and November 1st at Bard College. New York State pension news now. New York State pension funding rates are due to decrease for towns in the coming years due to improved performance of the stock market after many years of increases due to the financial crisis. In health insurance news, you may remember that New York State health insurance companies requested a 13% increase in premiums for next year from the state. This past month, the State Department of Financial Services approved rate increases averaging 5.7% for individual plans and 6.7% for small group plans. Representatives of insurers were not happy, warning that some insurers would drop out of the market or offer fewer plans. Good riddance, I say, one more step towards a more rational single-payer system. In casino news, New York State's Gaming Facility Location Board will announce the winners of the four new licenses for casinos this month coming up, after public hearings were held late last month. In an odd story from Politics on the Hudson, it stated that, quote, the AARP is urging state leaders to change New York's tax and regulatory policies to help aging residents stay in their homes and afford to stay in the state, unquote. But the report the story references does not mention taxes or regulation as factors that seniors say would make them likelier to retire in New York State. Rather, the executive summary of the report, titled State of the 50-plus in New York State and released in September, states that, quote, a majority of 50-plus New York State voters say they would be more likely to stay in the state as they age if improvements were made in the areas of, number one, health, 77% saying that, housing, 70%, transportation, 66%, and jobs, 61% for older residents, unquote. The report also cites utility cost increases as another reason for concern among seniors. No mention of taxes or regulation as such. So it was an odd lead from the writer into that. Now on to the elections. The race for governor has, of course, been dominated by incumbent Andrew Cuomo, less so by his running mate Kathy Hochul. Running on the Democratic Party, the Working Families Party, the Women's Equality Party, and the Independence Party lines. Trailing in second in the polls are Rob Astorino and Chris Moss on the Republican Party, the Conservative Party, and Stop Common Core lines. Also running are Green Party nominees Howie Hawkins and Brian Jones, Libertarian Party nominees Michael McDermott and Chris Edes, and the intriguingly named Sapient Party's Stephen Cohn and Bobby K. Colotti. The first two names, Cuomo and Astorino, have been soaking up most of the coverage, of course, but I'll tell you what I was able to find out about economic policy for all the candidates. I'll stick mostly to the first three candidates who have some clear proposals, but first the other guys. Michael McDermott, the Libertarian candidate, is short on details on his campaign site about what he would do if elected, but it is clear that he doesn't like regulation. He hilariously wonders what Steve Jobs or Jeff Bezos would have done if they had tried to start their businesses in New York. By the way, they're founders of Apple and Amazon, respectively. What with all the overregulation in New York compared to the libertarian dreamlands of Palo Alto, California, or Seattle, Washington, respectively? If you didn't catch the sarcasm there, I'll clue you in. I was being sarcastic. I myself often find myself in agreement with libertarians on some of the diagnosis of problems within our society, the influence of large corporations on the political process and their monopolistic practices. For example, the page on the Affordable Care Act on the libertarian candidate's website quotes Glenn Greenwald, of all people, outlining how the Affordable Care Act was a gift to the insurance industry. I couldn't agree more. I am more skeptical about his claim, though, that the horror stories are outweighing the successes of the act. That complaint has always sounded to me like the wailing of the privileged at being slightly inconvenienced, meanwhile ignoring the calamity that being completely shut out of health care has been for so many people in this country for too long, because they don't know any of those people. But the fact that this was reformed by, of, and for the insurance companies, I am completely on board with that. That's entirely what it was. However, I am always agog at the naivete of their solutions. Get rid of government altogether. Sovereign citizens are the best guarantee against multinational corporate power. And we'll all get a pony. Stephen Cohn's campaign does not have a website that I could find, but the Sapien Party's website is interesting enough. The front page is all Bobby K. Colote, the nominee for lieutenant governor, who is also the national chairperson of the Sapien Party. He's the first South Asian to run for lieutenant governor of New York, apparently. The website has a list of principles, none of which are attached to very concrete proposals. Based on some of the principles, I would say that we can be glad they're very marginal, politically speaking. Flat tax for all is their number two principle, right after integrity. And their principles are apparently geared towards the federal government, not New York. So long story short, cool name, but no platform. Steve Cohen, by the way, ran for governor in 2010 on the Independence Party line after a Tea Party nominating petition drive. So then, starting with everyone's favorite old-time religion, tax cuts, the governor's campaign mostly talks about what he's done so far, and this is true of all areas, with no real details of what he will do going forward. So we can assume it's just more of the same. That being said, Cuomo has cut income taxes, corporate taxes, and property taxes. The latter he calls the most onerous, without mentioning how it got that way. As an aside, I've covered this before, and the governor is not the only one guilty of this. Cough, cough, Astorino, cough. But it bears repeating that property taxes are as onerous as they are because federal income taxes and therefore spending have been cut repeatedly over the last 35 years. State income taxes and spending have been cut as well, which leaves towns and cities to fund educating and their other operations out of mostly property taxes. But let's cut those too. Why not? And education? Well, we're going to fix that too somehow. And we'll all be getting a pony. Astorino is proposing deeper cuts than Cuomo would likely to be offering, of course. And he's offering some specifics. Streamlined one-page tax form, which I guess will require getting rid of all those New York City and Yonkers taxes. I wonder what's going to replace that revenue. A 4% income tax rate on income below $200,000, or for couples, $300,000, with a 6% rate on all income above those lines. The elimination of the estate tax and making the property tax cap permanent. A moment to explain what economists mean when they talk about progressive versus regressive taxes. A progressive tax is one that increases as a percentage of total income as income rises, so that those with the highest incomes pay the greatest share of their income in taxes and vice versa. A regressive tax is just the opposite. The lowest income people would pay the greatest share of their income for such a tax. Sales taxes are generally regressive, which is why there are often exceptions for food, less expensive clothing, etc. So to be clear about what the governor has done and what Astorino promises to do should he be elected, the governor has produced a slightly more regressive tax system, while Astorino proposes to make this system much more regressive than it is. Hawkins, on the other hand, wants to go back to the much more progressive income tax system New York had in the 1970s, before the old-time tax cut religion revival swept the land. In addition, he wants to end corporate welfare, which are tax breaks and credits or subsidies to corporations, stop rebating the stock transfer tax, make estate taxes more progressive rather than cutting them entirely, and cut sales and property taxes. I think all this is a good idea, but unfortunately I also don't think it's going to go anywhere in the current political climate. On the flip side of taxes, of course, is spending, and Cuomo brags that he balanced the budget when he came into office. While this is true, factually, and unfortunately was required of him, the fact that the deficit was largely the result of the financial crisis and the Great Recession, that he cut so much out of education to do it, and that he hasn't replaced what he cut now that we're recovering, all make this something I wouldn't necessarily be bragging about. I can certainly see how it makes political sense for him as he lines up his presidential bid, but it's hardly been a service to the state of New York. He also claims to have fixed New York's pension system, which is an odd claim to say the least. While he has enabled some troubling accounting to allow local governments to pay less into their pension funds, it is based mostly on wishful thinking. Rob Astorino doesn't want to merely restrain the growth of spending, as the governor has done. He wants to reduce or hold flat state spending. This would include eliminating business tax credits, including the film tax credit, Medicaid reform, offering public employees defined contribution rather than defined benefit pensions. That last one has been a trend everywhere for decades now. And while it seems to be popular where there is a choice, it isn't clear how much of this is due to doubts about the state or corporation holding up its end of the bargain. That certainly went through my mind as I held my breath and signed up for the defined contribution plan in Massachusetts when I worked for the state there. What is clear is that tying your retirement benefits more closely to the stock market is great if you're retiring at a good time, unlike, say, the last 15 years. And if you put enough in, but people tend not to save enough, especially when they are young. Astorino also wants to replace retiree health plans with trusts, basically a savings plan for your future health needs. I'm sure that will work out great. Again, that was sarcasm. Astorino also proposes a constitutional amendment that would reduce the flexibility of the state government and its authorities to borrow money. That's not how it's stated, of course, but that effectively is what it means. Some of this may be a good idea. I'm sure reducing the authorities' ability to borrow would reduce the opportunities for corruption, for example. But the way things are now is already inflexible enough if the state's handling of the fiscal crisis brought about by the financial crisis and Great Recession are any example. Hawkins' proposals on spending are many. Specifically, he calls for state funding of state mandates, read Medicaid, and for restoring state revenue sharing to the 8% of the state's budget that it used to be. In addition, with the savings and increased revenue from the tax changes that he wants, Hawkins lays out a Green New Deal for New York State that will surely involve a lot of state spending. Included is an employer of last resort program that would provide public employment for the unemployed in projects identified as needed by communities, a state $15 per hour minimum wage that would include tipped workers, plus home rule for municipalities to set higher minimum wages if they want to, an income guarantee for those unable to work, single-payer health care to replace what we have now, education reforms, including equitable spending formulas, getting rid of the tax cap, fully funded full-day universal pre-K and kindergarten, free tuition at all state colleges and universities. He also calls for affordable housing and public transit, and a green energy economy by 2030. It's certainly ambitious, and I like all these proposals, but we would need a completely revolutionized political climate for all this to happen, I think. Of course, you don't get to a completely revolutionized political climate without starting. So, there's that. On the jobs economic development front, beyond the tax and spending plans I just outlined, which are all cast as part of the respective candidates' jobs and development plans, there are some other items worthy of mention for all three of these candidates. For the governor, we have basically the more of the same options, which includes casinos, targeted investments in industries like tourism, agriculture, booze, and nanotechnology, the regional economic development councils, which definitely have some potential if they're not hijacked by local interests looking to line their own pockets, Startup New York, which are the tax-free zones for new businesses around state colleges and universities, and the Charge New York program to invest in clean energy initiatives in the state. Notably absent is any discussion of fracking, either for or against. That said, while some of these, especially Startup New York and casinos, are doomed to fail at their stated objective, many of the rest are fine ideas that could make a difference. Rob Astorino's jobs plan is a fairly predictable set of ideas. Deregulation and tax cuts, which have always worked so well to concentrate income in the hands that are already full while lowering living standards for working people. Promoting fracking and effectively turning high schools into job training programs. Supporting high-tech startups and farms. There's certainly some useful stuff in there. Complete deregulation is a bad idea, but some New York regulations seem to be more part of a lawyer employment guarantee program than addressing where the market either ignores or creates problem that the state needs to step in and to prevent or fix. More promising is the idea of infrastructure investment using bank lawsuit settlement money and parts of the tech startup and farm support programs. Howie Hawkins, as you may have already have guessed, has a much more ambitious plan to revamp the New York state economy. Under the heading of economic democracy, he proposes creating a state bank to finance public spending projects and private businesses at lower cost than private banks do, supporting the creation of more worker and consumer cooperatives, creating a public energy system that would be 100% non-carbon and non-nuclear by 2030, and universal broadband access with net neutrality. He also proposes sustainable farming reforms, including income support and tax relief for working farmers, enabling farmers' democratic control over agricultural marketing and production processing cooperatives, a farm workers' bill of rights, and phasing out feedlots. He also has a labor plank in his platform that includes the right to organize, requiring just cause for firing, guaranteed basic income and retirement, paid family leave, and child and elder care, and comparable worth protections to promote gender equity and pay. On the whole, the governor is promising more of the same, which could be characterized as just enough to keep his own party from open revolt, but not too much to keep him out of contention for the 2020 presidential election. Rob Astorino is offering a watered-down version of the National Republicans' economic platform, and Howie Hawkins is offering to shoot for the moon. In my opinion, all three have at least some good ideas, but the Hawkins platform would work best for the workers in New York State if he could be elected and get the legislature to pass it all. And we'll all get a pony. I hope that helps. The race for New York State comptroller, while more subdued than the governor's race, features just as full a field. Incumbent Thomas DiNapoli is running on the Democratic Party, the Working Families Party, and the Independence Party and Women Equalities Party lines. Bob Antonucci, the Onondaga County Comptroller, is running on the Republican Party, Conservative Party, Life and Justice Party, and Stop Common Core lines. Teresa Portelli is the Green Party candidate. John Clifton is running on the Libertarian Party line. And the Rent is Too Damn High candidate is Greg Fisher. No Sapient Party candidate, alas. According to Ballotpedia, the duties of the comptroller as outlined in Article 5 of the state constitution are, quote, to audit all vouchers before payment and all official accounts, to audit the accrual and collection of all revenues and receipts, and to prescribe such methods of accounting as are necessary for the performance of the foregoing duties. Additionally, the legislature may also assign the following duties to the comptroller: supervision of the accounts of any political subdivision of the state, or powers and duties pertaining to or connected with the assessment and taxation of real estate. So in terms of making sure the state and its municipalities are spending their tax receipts correctly, this is the office with the power of audit and enforcement. DiNapoli is running on his 7.5-year record in the job, and it's generally a good one. According to his campaign website, he's worked with the Attorney General to root out fraud and corruption in state and local finances, reform the state pension fund, of which the comptroller is the sole trustee, assisted towns with the fiscal crisis that's evolved since the financial crisis and Great Recession, and improved diversity. The general impression I've gotten from the press he's received is very positive on all these fronts. Antonacci is also running on his record as the Onondaga County Comptroller, with similar claims about his activities there. He's been in that position as long as DiNapoli has been in the state comptroller's office. He seems to have the experience, but his campaign site doesn't offer any clues about what he would do differently than DiNapoli. Teresa Portelli would certainly offer a different look, especially if Hawkins was elected governor and was able to put into place some of the things he's talking about, such as a New York State bank. The Green Party platform, if implemented, would certainly expand the number of different programs and authorities that would require auditing, but also increase the dollar amounts. This means the comptroller's job would be even more important than it is now. The race for U.S. Representative for the 19th District has incumbent Chris Gibson, Republican of Kinderhook, being challenged by Sean Eldridge, longtime Democratic Party and marriage equality activist, and husband of Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes. Gibson has supported the farm bill, though he described it as not perfect. He says it does provide a lot of support for local farmers in our area. He's a supporter of farmland conservation and has opposed FERC's revamping of capacity zones that have driven up electricity rates in the region. On fracking, he's led the Republicans in the House on the Frack Act, which would force frackers to disclose the chemicals they use and force them to comply with the Safe Water Act, neither of which they're currently required to do. Gibson supports raising the minimum wage to $9, stating he believes $10 would cause too much job loss. Stay tuned for a thorough debunking of that idea. Frankly, although Eldridge has worked hard to differentiate himself from Gibson, there are not many economic issues separating the two. One such issue is fracking, although the difference is not great, with Gibson supporting states' decision-making power over fracking as opposed to a federal ban, and Eldridge coming right out and opposing fracking, although Gibson accuses Eldridge of making money from investments in fracking. Eldridge supports the Frack Act, which Gibson sponsored. Gibson supports Keystone XL, saying it will improve the economy. This is a popular talking point, but the main jobs impact will be construction. After that, it's just going to bring the dirtiest oil in the world from Canada to Texas to be shipped overseas with very few jobs needed to maintain it. Those construction jobs would be better put to use in other ways, like, say, building wind and solar farms. Burning all that tar sands oil will mean extra warming also. Climate scientists estimate that 2/3 of the current proven global reserves of oil and gas and coal need to stay buried to keep us from initiating catastrophic, for us especially, global warming. Gibson said he was too busy to attend the climate march, but then, full disclosure, so was I. And that's the elections wrap-up that I have time for. Now here's my interview with Jeanette Wicks Lim of the Political Economy Research Institute. We discuss the impacts minimum wages and living wage ordinances have on the economy of the areas that institute them. I'm here today with Jeanette Wicks Lim, Assistant Research Professor at the Political Economy Research Institute, located at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Thanks for joining us on your friendly neighborhood economist. So the minimum wage and wages in general have been in the news a lot recently with various minimum wage efforts from the president on down to, you know, Seattle and LA, and also the fast food worker organizing that's been going on around a $15 an hour wage. So I thought it was a good time to talk to you since you've been studying the, you know, wages in the low wage workforce for over a decade now. So I thought we could maybe start by, you could say a little bit about what are some of the arguments against having a minimum wage and raising the minimum wage that are put out there.
Sure. Yeah, this is, you know, debates about the minimum wage have been going on for decades. And so in each time the minimum wage, a minimum wage proposal comes up or a living wage ordinance is being considered, you have, I think, basically a repeat of the same debates. And so the main arguments against raising the minimum wage or establishing a living wage primarily are about job loss, you know, with the idea that employers are going to face higher labor costs that will cause them to cut back on hours or workers. And so that the very workers you were trying to help, these low-wage workers, will actually, in fact, be hurt because they will end up losing their jobs or getting their hours cut and thereby losing their earnings. So that's the primary argument against these laws. There is also an argument that's often made that a lot of beneficiaries of these kinds of labor standards are teenagers who don't really need to be earning that much money. They're just trying to earn pocket change. So I would say that those are the two most common arguments against these.
So how does the research that you've done answer those critiques?
Yeah. Well, let me start with the question about the teenagers first, because that's just about the easiest thing to answer, because all you really need to do is to, you know, we have, in the U.S., we're fortunate to have a ton of data really readily available for anybody to use. And you can just look and see who are low-wage workers in the U.S. workforce, and are they teenagers or are they not? And I think what happens in the arguments about these laws is how you spin the same facts, right? So if you look at the workers who'd get a raise from a minimum wage hike, for example, you see that there are a disproportionate number of teenagers. That is, you have more teenagers that would be benefiting from the minimum wage than you see broadly in the workforce, you know, teenagers working. So that you could say that. You can say, yes, they are more represented in the workers that would be benefiting. On the other hand, when you look at the workers who would be benefiting and what proportion of those workers are teenagers, what you're looking at, let me give you a concrete example, proposals to 1050, say, for the federal minimum wage. We looked at what workers would benefit from that proposal. 90% of those workers that would benefit from that minimum wage hike of the federal from 725 to 1050 would not be teenagers. So less than 10%, it was about 9%, would be teenagers. So if you just look at those numbers, you can say very clearly the vast majority of workers who benefit from a minimum wage hike from 725 to 1050 would not, in fact, be teenagers. So that's, you know, that's just a matter of, you know, looking at this numbers, it's pretty straightforward, and just saying, well, what are we actually talking about? The vast majority of these workers are not teenagers. So that I think is pretty clear to answer. You just have to keep on saying it over and over again. And in terms of job loss, this is a question that's been debated for literally decades in economics. There have been a multitude of studies, and I think if you just survey over the multitude of studies and said, well, what is sort of a summary way to describe what economists have found, you would say, well, minimum wage hikes seem to have at most a very modest effect on employment, you know, a modest negative or positive effect on employment, or no effect at all. So the range is some small effect centering around zero. That is no job loss, no job gain, nothing really happening to employment. But this has been something that's been ferociously debated over and over again. Are there any job losses? How much would it be, et cetera, et cetera? So I think it's frustrating, I think, for, say, you know, the voter to look at this question and say, well, you know, economists have been fighting about this for decades. How do we know what the true answer is? And, you know, a lot of times these debates end up going back and forth about technique, about data, you know, what did you measure incorrectly? And that's less helpful, I think, for the voter to say, well, you know, how do I decide what's actually true? So one of the things that we've tried to do here at Perry is to actually take a proposal and look at what the impact would be on businesses, and then think about, well, given this impact on businesses that we've now measured, what are reasonable adjustments that businesses could make? And would one of those be to lay off workers or cut back on their hours, so that we could more descriptively just think about, would it make sense for them to lay off workers or cut back on hours? So one of the things that we've done is, you know, when we look at how businesses would be impacted, we actually try to just calculate the cost. So we look at all the workers who are earning near minimum wages, what kind of raises would they get, how many hours do they work, and just really it's basic arithmetic. We just add up all these raises, and then we compare that to the revenue that businesses bring in to see, you know, could they absorb the cost increase that a particular proposal would impose on them. And what we found over and over again, and we've done this multiple times, you know, across the country in Arizona, Florida, New Orleans, in California, several different locations. And every time what we find is these proposals impose a very modest cost increase. So let me give you another concrete example from the proposal I just mentioned, this 1050 federal minimum wage. We looked specifically recently at what would the raise be for, how much would cost employers if we brought the federal minimum wage from 725 to 1050. How much would that cost fast food employers? Because those are the ones that are most impacted by minimum wage laws. And so we calculated the raises, how many workers would get that raise, how many hours do they work, and then compared that to the revenue that fast food employers bring in. And we estimated that the cost increase for those fast food employers would be about 2.7% of their revenue. So just to give you a sense of what does that mean, is that big or small, you can imagine that one way that employers would adjust to a minimum wage hike, you know, once their labor costs were going up, is to increase their prices. And this is very often a way that employers do adjust to a minimum wage hike, is they raise their prices somewhat. So in order to cover the costs of this, the minimum wage hike from $7.25 to $10.50, a fast food employer would basically need to raise their prices 2.7% to fully cover the costs of this minimum wage hike. So, for example, if you had a $4.50 Big Mac, you'd be paying now $4.60 approximately. That would be the size of the price increase that the employer would be now instituting to cover the cost of minimum wage. So in that sense, you can imagine as a consumer, that's a relatively modest cost increase, 2.7%. Now, it's not just the case that when the minimum wage goes up, that the employer's costs go up. There are other ways that employers can offset this cost increase, aside from raising prices. One thing that's been found over and over again in research is that turnover rates amongst the workers go down. That is, the rate at which workers leave their jobs and employers have to go and find new workers to replace them, that goes down. And that actually saves employer money because there's less money spent on recruiting workers, training workers, and there are more experienced workers on the staff so that they are more productive workers that continue to work at their establishments. So some of that cost increase is offset. So you wouldn't see necessarily the 2.7% cost increase reflected fully in a price increase. You'd see some portion of that. So you're talking about something smaller than 10-cent increase in the price of a burger to cover fully the cost of a minimum wage hike like what was proposed at $10.50. This was, by the way, a proposal by Alan Grayson down in Florida. He was proposing this increase to the federal minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. So five cents more for a Big Mac, that seems more than worth it for such.
Well, so that's the question. You know, how do consumers respond? And I think that what we've seen in the literature is that, you know, price increases of that degree, that modest, doesn't really impact consumer demand. And that's why that helps explain why you don't see much of an employment impact when you're looking at minimum wage hikes of that size. You know, they just don't have a large enough impact for that to affect employers in such a way that they would want to lay off their workers and, you know, or cut back on their hours. And one of the things I try to emphasize is that, you know, it's not costless for employers to lay off workers, right?
Right.
It's, you know, they have those workers on staff for a reason. You know, they need to have them get work done. So to lose that staff creates a burden for the business. But also, they're losing workers that they have experience with. These are workers that they know. So now they are, you know, in a position where they're going to have to recruit new workers that they don't know if they are planning on, you know, turning over some of those positions. And that imposes another cost on the employer. So it's not costless for employers to lay off workers or cut back on their hours, and the cost increase that these minimum wage hikes impose on employers are relatively modest, so that there are other ways that employers tend to adjust. That's what we observe in the data, that it's not so much employment that they adjust around, but on other factors, and the price increase is one of the primary ways.
So the same kind of argument then would apply to, you know, oh, this is going to affect small businesses.
Yeah.
Not McDonald's, which people don't usually think of as a small business, although it really is, since there are a lot of franchise owners, right?
Right. So I haven't done a lot of research looking specifically at small businesses, but we have done at Perry, there's been some studies done specifically looking at minimum wage hikes, the impact by business size. And there hasn't, from that research, I haven't seen any pattern where the small businesses have actually seen a larger increase. And I think that has something to do with the number of workers who are working at that very low wage rate. You have a different distribution of workers than what you have at, say, Target or McDonald's, where you have a huge number of low-wage workers. So their workforce is much more dominated by the low-wage workers who would be getting minimum wage increases than what you see at small businesses. But that's not something I've, you know, specialized in, so I don't have all the specifics in that case.
So that kind of leads me on to another question. So I've been thinking, you know, with Seattle, the city of Seattle raising its minimum wage to $15 an hour. I'm wondering, you know, that's a kind of a sizable jump compared to other, you know, minimum wage increases that have happened before. Usually when you see a minimum wage increase, it's statewide and kind of more incremental.
Yeah.
Even I wondered, and I'm not a person who thinks that minimum wages are job killers or whatever, but even I wondered, is that a bridge too far almost? So for businesses like Target or McDonald's, are they now more likely to locate outside of the Seattle city limits than inside?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. And I think it's going to be an interesting one for us to watch because they are. This is a hike that is more sizable than what we've seen in the past. I think in terms of, you know, specifically what you were just mentioning, this question about like Target or some or the retailer. I just want to say with retailers, it's interesting that even though you think of retailers as these big low-wage employers, and they are, the cost to those kinds of businesses is much smaller than even fast food restaurants. So the actual impact, I haven't calculated for a $15 increase minimum wage for retailers, but I can tell you it's going to be small. I mean, given all the research we've done, it's going to be a small price increase. You know, if I had to guess, I would say something on the order of a 1% cost increase relative to sales. That is, they could cover their costs by a 1% price increase across the board. So in that sense, I don't think that it'll have much of an impact on them, though they may make a lot of noise about it. I think that what is going to be helpful for us is to actually see what happens. I mean, Seattle's raising their minimum wage to $15, but they're doing it over a series of years. They're not doing it, you know, all in one fell swoop. And so there'll be a chance for businesses to figure out, you know, how do they adjust over time. And then there are a couple of things that is, I think, really important to, you know, just sort of keep in mind when these proposals come up is that where we are with the federal minimum wage is just such a low bar to be starting from. And I think that's why it feels very unusual or maybe like a big stretch to get to $15 an hour. You know, if you think about where we were in 1968, what the minimum wage was, the federal minimum wage, so across the board, across the country, you know, if that minimum wage had just been inflation adjusted to today, we'd be talking about something on the order of a $10.70 federal minimum wage. And that's across the nation, not in a high cost area like Seattle. But then if you also take into account that workers are much more productive than they used to be, right? So worker productivity has more than doubled since, you know, the late 1960s. And so you have a much more productive workforce. But the economy, the low-wage portion of the economy, has not kept pace with these kinds of increases. And so we are starting at a very low bar at $7.25 for the federal minimum wage. And while $15 an hour may have been, you know, quite reasonable if we had been adjusting over time, it feels like a big step now. But I think the question now is to say, well, let's see what's going to happen. Employers are going to have to figure out ways to adjust. Some employers you might think would be really hit hard, but I don't think they actually are. Retailers, for example. The harder question is going to be for, say, restaurants or fast food businesses where I think their cost increases are going to be more on the order of 5%. And trying to think about, well, what will they need to do to adjust to a cost increase of that size? And because it's going to be incremental over time, they'll have time to figure out, you know, what are ways that they could adjust to that. And if Seattle is a high-cost place, which it is, paying the workers at these establishments at this higher rate makes a lot of sense in those areas. So, you know, they have a much higher cost of living. They're going to need a higher minimum wage. And so you see examples of that, like in New York City, you know, the living wage ordinance there has just been expanded. You've seen Los Angeles, the hotel workers just passed a higher minimum wage for hotel workers. I think that we're seeing movements like that because, you know, we need to see movement in the low wage part of our workforce, and we need something that is much more substantial than the incremental minimum wage hikes that you were just talking about, because we are finding that the low end of the wage distribution keeps on dragging. It's dragging over time relative to what we used to have as our law, and then what we could support given the way our economy has grown.
And Washington State also had one of the higher state minimum wages as well, right? Wasn't it almost $10?
Yeah, I think Washington has gotten to $10. And yeah. Massachusetts, I believe, in a year or two is going to get to 11, if I remember correctly. So, you know, you see a lot of movement because we have been stuck with this federal minimum wage at $7.25 since what the late, you know, 2008, when the last 7, 8, 9, that the last federal minimum wage hike increase went into effect. But I think it is a fair question. We haven't seen a situation where we've gone from, say, $7.25 to $15 an hour, something, you know, doubles. We need to just watch and see how employers adjust. And I think sort of my view on it is that the impact is going to be smaller than what people aren't sort of speculating in terms of what is the actual cost increase to employers. So there are a multiple of ways that employers can adjust. And it's just a matter of seeing, you know, what is it that the employers do, and how do we support the economy so that the employers have different avenues of doing that. I mean, there are, you know, if you think about it, there's the price increase, right? There's slower wage growth for high wage workers. There's a smaller profit margin. There's just expanding revenue. If the economy is really robust, there's expanding revenue sources that way because their revenue is expanding. Higher productivity amongst workers, lower turnover, really investing in their workforce. There are already existing businesses that have a higher wage, right? You know, if you think of, you know, what's the classic example is Costco, right? They already pay their workers fairly well. Their, you know, Gap, you know, before the federal minimum wage, whatever, if we have a federal minimum wage increase, I don't know if we will, but it's been talked about for a long time. In any case, Gap anticipates, you know, or I think they anticipated that there will be a federal minimum wage increase and have already adopted a higher minimum wage. So, you know, it's not that employers can't adjust to this kind of a higher wage floor. It's just, you know, making an adjustment to it and then and having our economy support that.
So basically, it's just going to be the usual suspects crying that the sky is falling. Horrible things are going to happen if we treat people well. So we can't afford to do that.
Right, right. Well, I mean, and I think that's interesting is that the debate is always the same whenever there's a minimum wage hike. It's always the same, even though the facts don't change in terms of do we actually see big swings in employment? Do we see anything empirically measurable that shows us that there's this negative impact on employment? I mean, really, regardless of what the actual minimum wage hike is, you know, are we talking about 10%, 20%, 30% minimum wage hike? It's always the same argument that this guy is going to fall. Yeah. And in fact, this guy doesn't fall. So, you know, it really is an empirical exercise to see what happens to, with a $15 minimum wage. And my guess is that employers will find ways to adjust that don't produce some big swing in employment, some big hit to employment.
So, Jeanette, I know you recently did a study of the impact of a living wage ordinance on Sonoma County in California. Could you say a little bit about Sonoma County, what it is, what it's like, what the ordinance is going to be, and what you found out about what the probable impacts might be?
Right. So in Sonoma County, they're considering a living wage ordinance. It's kind of your traditional living wage ordinance where it covers employers who do business with the county. So that includes employers who, say, have service contracts with the county. It also includes employers that receive business subsidies from the county. So, for example, they might get a loan that has a very low rate, a favorable rate, because they're doing some kind of business that the county wants to support. It also covers county employees, you know, so workers who work directly for the county. And one of the larger segments of the workforce that's going to be covered are these home care workers. The program in California is called IHSS, and it's, I think, in-home supportive services. Basically, these are home care workers who take care of elderly or disabled adults so that they can remain living at home as opposed to, say, living in a nursing care facility. This is covered by Medicaid funds because it's for low-income individuals. So that's one of the larger groups of workers that would be covered. So Sonoma County, actually, there are several cities within Sonoma County that already have living wage ordinances in effect. And so this is kind of broadening out the living wage ordinances that would be applied in the area. And the wage level that they're proposing is $15 an hour. So, you know, this is kind of sort of a common a labor standard that's now being talked about. And so North Bay Jobs with Justice asked me to look at what would the impact be on the county government itself, its budget. And so I looked at what the impact would be for their service contracts, because that's always a concern. Well, now that employer businesses there that hold contracts with the county, they're now going to ask to get more money for their services because this living wage ordinance would apply to them. So that's one group. business subsidies are used by the county to promote economic growth. And so there's a concern that that would reduce the amount of economic growth in the area. And then there are the IHSS workers that the county, it's kind of a unique situation with the IHSS workers. Their wages are funded by the county, state, and the federal government because it's a Medicaid program, but it's like a shared cost of their of those workers' earnings. I've done this a couple different times at least where I've looked at the fiscal impact. And the story with contractors is pretty much the same in that the impact on this county budget from the contractors is going to be relatively small. And you know that has to do with a combination of what kind of services these contracts cover. There's the county government has lots of services that require a lot of high paid workers, but there are also a lot of services that like groundskeepers and that sort of thing that have low wage workers. So there's a combination of the kinds of employers that they have contracts with. So it's a portion of that business that they have. But then when you look at in the grand scheme of what the county's budget looks like, it takes a relatively small portion. And past research has found that employers who do business with county governments, you know, through these service contracts, they don't pass along the full cost of their wage increases because there's a reason why the businesses want the county contracts, service contracts, right? There's a favorable situation there. So they're not going to just pass along all their costs to the county necessarily.
Right.
So that tends to be somewhat modest. There hasn't been any evidence that I've seen that business subsidy clauses of living wage ordinances have any impact on the economic growth of an area. So that one's harder to pin down just because it's not always clear that the businesses that are supposed to be covered are actually covered, you know, that the ordinance is actually implemented the way it's meant to be implemented. And then there are a lot of reasons why businesses move to an area that's not necessarily going to be tied to this specific ordinance. And there's something about the area, the particular area that's advantageous to them. And on top of that, they're getting some sort of subsidy. So there are lots of reasons why businesses would continue to move to an area even though it might have a higher labor standard than it would somewhere else. Now, the largest cost that the county government would be facing is the IHSS workers, because they're relatively low-paid workers, so they'd be going from about $9 an hour to, I'm sorry, not $9 an hour, they're going from, I think about $12 an hour is the rate, to 15, but there's a large workforce, and the county is responsible for a portion of that. So those workers are going to impose the largest share of the costs. One thing that I found really interesting when I was doing this work is that with IHSS workers, these in-home supportive care service workers, they actually are quite cost effective if you look at the services they provide. They actually provide care for people to stay living at home, which is so much cheaper and actually what people prefer than having them live in a nursing care facility. You know, living outside their own home, less independently, it just costs just a lot more. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it's, you know, at least two or three times. I'm sure I'm off by some number, but it's there's such a cost savings to keeping people in their homes as opposed to having them move to a nursing care facility. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the way the costs are shared, the way California has things set up, the county would have to pay for all the raises that the living wage ordinance would impose or would require. And the state won't pay for any of it. So even though the state would actually save some money by having more people staying at home rather than living in nursing care facilities, because the state is responsible for paying for the nursing care facility care, the state is right now in a place where it won't support the higher living wage. So, you know, I think that there needs to be more discussion that talks about what are the cost savings to having a higher paid workforce, particularly for this kind of service in the area. You know, just as a sort of bottom line that I can say about the impact of this proposal is, even with all this, when I crunched all the numbers and figured out what it would cost the county, it was going to add up to less than 1% of the county's total budget, mm-hmm. which is similar to what we found, and I should say we, that researchers have found in other places over and over again. The costs have been something less than 1% of the total budget. So, again, this is another case where it might sound large. $15 an hour sounds large, but when you look at it in the whole, you know, in the big picture of what are we actually talking about in terms of cost increase, it's a relatively modest cost increase. So there are ways to adjust. It's a matter of figuring out what are those ways to adjust. But just to put the number on it, what are we actually talking about, I think helps start the conversation in the right place.
That's all we have time for this month. Join me next time for more scintillating insights into the day's economic developments, won't you? Until then, your friendly neighborhood economist, out. This has been your friendly neighborhood economist. I can be heard on the second Tuesday of every month at 10 a.m. or at any time online. Check me out on WGXC.org, on Facebook, just search for your friendly neighborhood economist, on my new homepage at yfneconomist.blogspot.com, where I'll post show notes and links to the show, on my Tumblr blog at yfneconomist.tumblr.com, or on Twitter at yfneconomist. If you've got a question you've been dying to ask a sympathetic economist, ask me through one of these avenues or email me at yfneconomist@gmail.com. I'm always happy to hear and answer questions, so please send them in. Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist is a production of WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, New York, and Thomas Masterson.